Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I'm your host, Graham Culbertson, and I'm here today to discuss this book of essays called Incompleteness with the author, Amit Chowdhury. So, Amit, can you begin by telling us a bit about who you are? I know you're best known as a novelist, but there's a lot more to it than that, and then we can get to these essays.
Is it true about me being best known as a novelist? I think that is true. For what reason, I don't know, but yes. Yeah. I mean, I'm a person who's written 8 novels. The 9th novel is coming out this year. But the novels are not in the lineage of 19th century realist novels. So you don't have to write a contemporary version of a 19th century novel to be in that lineage. I mean, I'm just saying that the novels are partly essayistic, partly just kind of visual. They sort of make the matter of plot secondary. The excitement for me lies elsewhere. So I say this to kind of to imply that I can't call myself a novelist without explaining what kind of novelist I am, and which makes me fit in sort of not. I'm at an angle, I suppose, both to the Indian novel and to the Indian novel in English, as it's come to be known as the Indian novel, and I'm also at an angle to other kinds of narratives and stories which are recognizably novels. Now, it's a nice thing that other kinds of ideas of the novel have been resurfacing. I say resurfacing because there were aberrations in the early on in the 20th century from the kind of realist framework of the novel into a more sensory account of the novel, say with people like Wolfe, to name just one person. So Wolfe now is kind of what she means is it seems to be quite distant from people's actual sort of conception of the novel. I mean, they're happy to read Wolfe, but they're not happy to think in what way, you know, that kind of novel departed from the norm and what it might mean to us today, whether it's still a viable kind of desire to depart from the norm and in what ways we might still do it today if we wanted to. But a resurfacing has occurred maybe through the European novel, you know, certain names come to mind, like Zebold, for instance, or more recently Annie Ernaux. But that discussion also leaves out somebody from my part of the world. And the history that produces this kind of non-realist novel in my part of the world. So it means that anytime I make a kind of statement about being a novelist, I have to say a whole lot of other things about what I've been arguing for. And because I've been arguing for this, partly through the act of writing these novels itself, but also through other kinds of work, including essays. Partly for that reason, we have this kind of a body of work, as far as I'm concerned, in the essay form as well, of which this book is a kind of selection, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's... there's already enough there to take up the rest of our time, I would say. I'm so struck by, you know, And I'm going to try not to lapse into academic jargon. It's just so easy because this, you know, before things were problematic, meaning before pop stars were problematic because we didn't like their relationships or whatever, it was a task in classrooms to problematize something by which meant sort of dialectical or deconstruction. This, I mean, again, I'm lapsing into academic jargon, which is say, oh, well, here's this category that seems stable and fixed and received and in some ways bourgeois and teleological. Yeah. And in fact, it's not. It's not any of those things. It's all of them and many other things.
Yeah.
And it strikes me that, you know, if I may be so bold, your entire career has been about problematizing all of these things that you found, the novel, the essay, the concept of a Western tradition, the concept of an Indian tradition, you know, the figure, the figure who crops up in this way frequently. He was just a Jeopardy question a couple months ago. I can't pronounce his name. The last name is Tagore. But the question was, you know, and it was one of the famous pictures of Tagore later in life. And the question was, you know, this man wrote the national anthem of both India and the state, Bengal. And that's problematization right there. Wait, is Tagore the national poet of India, or is he the national poet of this sub thing of India? And he's both. And it's not going to resolve in an easy, simple way that someone would like to resolve if they want to answer a question of what is the Indian novel, or, you know, it's not just India, what is the English novel? These are questions that are endlessly recursive, and I'm always interested in questioning and breaking and refashioning, and it just strikes me that you have been as well. That was probably too bold, but it's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you see it that way, because absolutely, I mean, my way of seeing it would be to say that I have found it difficult to take anything, whether it's something called being a writer or writing novels or the idea of the novel or the idea of writing or the idea of India or any other kind of category, difficult to take as a given. That there are no givens. Before I proceed with that line of thought, I should just say that the Jeopardy question. So Tagore wrote songs or pieces which were adopted as national anthems by India and Bangladesh, not the state of Bangladesh.
I got this wrong. Yes.
Yeah. So just to clarify that, and yeah, that song which was adopted by Bangladesh as its national anthem is actually a beautiful song about Bengal. It is about Bengal, but anyway, so
I guess I'm sorry if we can just for a moment, for the people who don't know, Bengal. I mean, this is just the confusion of history, and I'm gonna say what Bengal is, and then you can explain what I've got wrong about it. Bengal is a unit which, if India were to become a group of countries the way Europe is, would be its own country, except it was partitioned into two parts, supposedly a Muslim part and a Hindu part, and the Muslim part became part of Pakistan and then its own place called Bangladesh. If I have that right ish
Okay. when India was partitioned, it was partitioned in the West and partitioned in the East, and the eastern part that was partitioned was largely the province of Bengal, undivided Bengal, and partitioned, as you say, on the basis of kind of religion. So that became East Pakistan. And then early in the 70s, it became, there was a freedom struggle, which was based on a difference of opinion about language rather than religion. So the Bengali part of Bengali speaking part of of Pakistan wanted its language, not to be sidelined, And that became the basis of the freedom struggle. And from the freedom struggle emerged Bangladesh, which is what it's now called.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Yes. Everyone would know this in certain parts of the world, and over here where I am in the United States. I mean, people don't know there was a joke that people don't understand that the United Kingdom is in fact Americans don't understand, you know, the relationship between Wales, Scotland, and England. So understanding the relationship between Bangladesh and India, it's just it's hopeless.
That's kind of mind-boggling, sort of talk about problematic. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry I distracted you. I think you were talking about the Tagore, the national anthem, and I got us off track.
No,
I'm sorry.
I was talking about the fact that it's difficult for me to take anything as a given, and has been difficult for a very long time. Earlier, I don't think when I was 16 years older, you know, when I would have first felt that, you know, this doesn't quite fit. It's not as if I understood why and how it maybe needed to be addressed critically or through some sort of critical sort of awareness of something no longer fitting and therefore being essentially discardable and of interest only historically. And this was true of every almost every concept that I inhabited, you know. But so the project of not an intentional project, but the project of uncovering ways of understanding this and always annotating, you know, concepts which are taken as givens, needing to annotate them in the way I annotated my own statement about being a novelist, that began to happen through my life, basically. It's a matter of starting from scratch, as it were, not sort of pretending that there is any kind of stable body of knowledge about oneself, a stable kind of prefabricated definition of oneself or what I'm doing that I can fall back on without annotation, but I think this is true of the way I write novels as well, especially the, you know, the given that the novels are not necessarily about conflict and plot but about a different kind of excitement to do with life that isn't organized into narrative or plot. I don't have any ready-made language with which to write about it. And I don't think anybody has a ready-made language to talk about anything. And in this sense, I suppose, although it might be unfashionable to say so, I want to make it fashionable. Of course, I won't be able to because I don't have that position or power. But you know, the Buddhist idea of flux, of unfixedness, applies to language and the way we write. There is no stable kind of category. There's no stable reality for me to fall back on language and describe that reality and say that, you know, the sunset was beautiful. It doesn't mean anything, not because it's a cliche, but because there is no stable reality. If I do want to write this, I will have to find new words for it, because that moment has passed. You know, it had no permanence. So the constantly changing nature of things necessitates a search for new language, whether it's critical language or the language with which you write fiction, novels, poetry.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And what you're all you're left with then is your own ability to make sense of the world around it and then express it in any way you can. And that is the essayistic tradition. And again, to get a little too schematic, you know, at least in Western philosophy, essentially I divide philosophers into roughly these two groups, the post-Plato ones who say that there is a received order and it makes sense, and your job is to uncover that and sort of solidify or uncover the solidity of the universe and of truth that already exists. And then there's Heraclitus, for whom flux is everything. And, you know, to I was just emailing someone who said they weren't sure they wanted to come on this podcast because it was, you know, too political. And actually, as I started this podcast, politics wasn't the main thing. This question of flux and uncovering was what I was really interested in. And anarchy was I was much more interested in the way that traffic flowed anarchically and organically than I was in, you know, political reform. The podcast has skewed political over time, but this question of flux and the everyday and, you know, recovery, these William James and Ralph Waldo Emerson questions that shade into Buddhism and Heraclitus, that's what I'm interested in. And when I discovered your work, I mean, I just, every paragraph is on fire, or I should say every paragraph lights my mind on fire with this questing and exploring for making sense of this irreducible world. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
I guess I should ask a question or something, but you can respond to that if you would like.
I think that's very, very kind of you to put it that way. I even think to say that there is a person, a kind of subjectivity there, trying to make sense of the world is overstating the case on behalf of that subjectivity. Even subjectivity is something that is an uncomfortable sort of residue of some sort of habit of thinking. It has too much baggage. But you're right to bring the everyday into this conversation and to kind of see it as part of this, essential to this argumentation about the fact that there can be no givens in language, conceptually, or in the way we think about what we call the world or reality. That the everyday is not just some sort of beautiful sort of dimension of the small or the quotidian, but it is this kind of thing through which the unfixed manifests itself, and therefore it's what cannot be, it's tied up with this unwillingness to domesticate into sort of static categories. The moment you use a term like the everyday, you also then begin to think of it in terms of a category. So again, you have to annotate. Again, you have to militate against the everyday. But you're right to bring it up, because the everyday is not just some form of nature. It is deeply woven into our sort of encounter with the unfixedness of the world, and therefore is woven into our critical belief in the unfixedness of you know, our concepts of language and our relationship to the world. And I think you're also right to make that, to note that division between before Plato and after Plato, the kind of Nietzsche's kind of insight into that particular battlefield, and the way it might be of interest to somebody like me, to whom many things that we encounter now and have been taught to think of in a certain way and have been educated in are the result of a kind of gradual colonization by the Enlightenment, by Plato, you know, and when we think of somebody like Heraclitus, we are thinking of some, we're talking about catching the glimmer of something that lies on the edges of that colonizing machine. Just vaguely, barely accessible to us. Something that must have at one time, of course, a kind of worldview like that always has to be somewhat marginal, but must have had a greater presence than it does now, you know, at one time. So to mention that is to remind us of a world where that kind of, the kind of thought we're talking about now, maybe had a greater presence even in the, on the margins of the way, you know, people thought through things than after this kind of colonizing move, where Heraclitus becomes somebody very distant and exotic, you know.
Yeah, well, the other version of this, and this comes from Nietzsche, especially with Zoroaster, and I think with, you know, Emerson is interested in both Hinduism and Buddhism, is to say, there's this thing, this Platonic thing that, you know, through the Enlightenment and Kant has colonized everything in the West. But there's this thing called the Orient, where these ideas are still, you know, true and beautiful, and we must dig underneath the orientalizing, or indeed underneath the modernity of, you know, Calcutta or Delhi, and find the living, breathing heart of the Orient underneath. And that obviously is not that sort of simplistic answer of way to recover this tradition is absurd, but I do think it's probably still practiced in, you know, post-colonial departments and things like that.
This idea that there is a West colonized by the Enlightenment, and there's an Orient, which has different ways of thinking. It doesn't quite hold. Those different ways of thinking have always historically been marginal in a place like India as well, and they're always always in the danger of being canonized and therefore domesticated and turned into something completely different from what they are. And they are even turned into something different by translation into English, by translation into, you know, the wisdom of the East or whatever. But Indians themselves are products of the Enlightenment, are themselves great Orientalists. They're among the great, the biggest Orientalists on the planet. The West, I mean, the West is a mythic category. When we think of the West, we only think of certain bits of the West. The other bits don't exist. So the West has its own Orient, as it were. And the West has its own traditions, which have some continuity with the Heraclitus that you're talking about, which are completely marginalized, but maybe exist. So what we are looking at in as far as the West is concerned is a kind of auto-colonization via the Enlightenment in order to produce some entity called the West, which is actually bits of Western Europe. Western Europe itself is being reconfigured all the time. Not all of Western Europe fits into Western Europe. And thereby, not all of it fits into the West. So I'm interested in the elisions of location and the creation of categories, only because I'm interested in reaching out towards that kind of thinking to do with the unfixed, but at the same time, I'm interested in what has created categories to make it difficult for us to reach out to them, and what makes us kind of also turn these other ways of thinking into inert kind of things by romanticizing them, by giving them specific locations, by giving them a specific sort of texture and tenor. I want to escape all that arrive at this place where these categories, including West and East, are pretty useless, actually.
I think they're more than useless. I think, you know, holding on to them as analytical categories will prevent you from seeing what is right there in front of you. You know, I think that there's people in American, you know, English departments who have post-colonial in their title, who are really trying to recover this, you know, this authentic East underneath the colonizing of modernity. And they really mean quite well, but I'm very skeptical of their project. And I was mentioning Said as, in many, I think Said is sort of one of the authorizers of this project. And for all of his wonderful activism and his very well-meaning desire to fight oppression, I think when I read the book Orientalism for the first time, when he says sort of like, you know, the Orient isn't a real thing, it's just a bunch of texts the Westerners made up, I never thought he proved that the Orient was a real thing in a way that he seemed to want to. He just has a different set of texts that he's interested in and never actually gets to the quotidian and the everyday in a way that you have. So that's sort of what I said, and now you can respond to that, or we can move on however you wish.
I can only imagine how very closed literary studies and you know, English departments, the humanities might have been for Said's book Orientalism to seem like a necessary thing, and it was necessary,
yeah,
definitely. But it became a central text, and it spawned a way of sort of thinking about cultures that surely it didn't intend to be the key to how we think about the way cultures even related to each other by dominance, and cultures are related to each other by dominance, and they're themselves shaped by internal kind of struggles to do with dominance. At every point of time, surely this book, revealing and necessary though it might have been, cannot be useful as the sole sort of key to understanding what this kind of intercultural world of ours shaped in part by dominance, imperialism, but shaped by various other kind of arguments as well, has been about. So the problem is not so much with the text itself as much as the fact that it is being taken to be some sort of a way of talking about a particular kind of reality again and again and again, returning to this book for it to provide a set of terms through which we'll talk about this reality repeatedly. That became a problem because empire and colonization, important as they are, and as I said, very necessary to constantly remind those who come from a culture that has colonized about what they're not seeing, what they're taking for granted, very necessary. But it's not the definitive sort of there is no definitive sort of thing or factor to how this, how these very complex cultures have evolved and what they kind of, especially in the domain of writing and the arts, the radical shifts that have taken place, how those shifts have taken place across the world, some of it better known. We know more about the shifts in Europe. We know more about Picasso and Monet than we know about, what was happening, say, in a court in the early 19th century, where a kind of abstract painting may have been created. We know less about that. But these directions which are sort of which the arts are going into, which can which end up in with various kind of having various results, including this thing called North Indian classical music taking the shape it has come to take, which is a modernist non-representational kind of shape. All of this is happening. All of these things are being fought for, argued over, thought about. Risks are being taken. So there is no to say that empire and colonization are not only important, they are definitive to the exclusion of everything else. It takes you to a dead end. Makes you means you have to erase most of the history that has formed you, And if it's the kind of intention of free market globalization to do precisely that, then well, it's been done. It has had good sort of a good partner in sort of this view becoming such a dominant view. I think we have to, yeah, I think we need to free ourselves from the dominance of this particular view of empire in a time of globalization, in a time when globalization is through its hostility to what came before is kind of engaged in making unavailable what went before. And what went before is what has created our modernities, our paintings, our films, our languages. all of which now appear to us either curated or in museums or in a very narrowed down fashion, as if they don't actually speak to us. So I think, yeah, it would be good to not, in the process of underlining the inequities or the depredations of imperialism, forget that we are now in the time of free market globalization, where there is a strategic hostility to the kind of multiple kind of things that have gone into making us, and by reducing that multiplicity to a story simply of colonization, rather than seeing colonization as one important element, to not engage with any other element, is to collaborate with this triumphal discourse of globalization, which is also hostile to that multiplicity which has formed us, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, no, I know. I completely agree. And there's a wonderful essay in Incompleteness. Maybe it's called like The Piazza and the Car Park, something
right,
like that.
Right. Yes.
And it's got these delightful phrases in there about this new thing, quote, all time, which is just this hilarious phrasing. So I was listening to NPR recently, and they were interviewing the woman who played Miranda on Sex and the City, and they introduced her as having played one of the most, quote, iconic characters of all time, close quote. And it's just like, all time, like, because for these people, Sex and the City, which it had a revival, but it's about 25 years old now, that's as far back as they can think. All time ends about 25 years ago. They didn't say all time TV characters, which TV has an 80-year run, and I don't think Miranda cracks all time TV characters, but like, what about Don Quixote, you know, like, where, like, this complete lack of remembering of all of the traditions. Go ahead.
It's a deliberate kind of erasure, where you use all the time in order to sort of make unavailable. That's a kind of a strategy you have. It's an aggressive, triumphal strategy. It has to sound upbeat. I mean, it always has to sound upbeat and triumphant, because that's the language in which we operate now. Whatever we say has to sound upbeat and triumphant. The fun of failure, the comedy, the fun, the poetry, and the and the anarchy, to borrow from you, of the freeing anarchy of failure is very different from the energies that can only express themselves in terms of triumph. You know, it doesn't occur to people that energy, a freeing energy, a comic energy, a revivifying energy, can be expressed in terms of failing.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't occur to people anymore. Quixote, for instance, is emblematic of that kind of energy. But that kind of vocabulary, again, sort of is part of what's not available to us anymore. So whenever we talk about energy, it has to be in these upbeat, triumphant, in this upbeat vocabulary.
Yeah, that, I mean, as you were talking about failure, it reminded me of, so I was taught that this filmmaker, Orson Welles, often considered, you know, the greatest filmmaker of all time, that his career is a trajectory of failure. And it's true that his first and most acclaimed movie, Citizen Kane, was the only one where he really got to do whatever he want with the full budget. And it's the one it's now jockeying in these famous lists of greatest film of all time for one, two,
all time,
or three. But in fact, as my, I love Citizen Kane. I think every single one of Welles' later films are more interesting, and they are filled with an energy. I think all of them are filled with an energy, except for maybe the second one, which is I can't remember the name of the second one, but it was the second one that he made with full backing of the studio, and then they took the backing away from him. It's about the guy who invents a car. Anyways, these films of failure are so thrilling, and the stories that go with them of Welles, you know, ending up somewhere in Europe just begging people for money. There's so much there, and it was so creative and fertile and chaotic and anarchic in all of the best ways. And if Welles had been Hitchcock and just gotten to make the Wellesian vision for 40 years, but increasingly tied it into standard Hollywood filmmaking, I can't imagine he wouldn't be taught as a failure, but I can't imagine I would find his films as thrilling. And this, none of his films besides Citizen Kane are in the greatest films of all time, but they're all so fascinating.
Absolutely. I've only seen two other films, The Magnificent Ambersons.
That's the one I was thinking of. Yes. Sorry. Go ahead.
I think it's great. I mean, I know he had to kind of change the ending. A Touch of Evil, which I also like immensely. It's worrying when this particular energy, which we thought and criticism and the imagination are attuned to, can only be expressed in terms of a sort of upbeat or triumphal vocabulary. The energy cannot be expressed mimetically. You know, I mean, it's not a one-to-one between language and the way we feel revived and feeling good about something or succeeding at something. I think a good example of this, I've been looking at things in these Indian lineages, which of course which includes Buddhism, which I've just talked about, which of course are cast as religions, but are not religions at all. They are some the ones which resurfaced with modernity and were sort of attended to by people like, you know, John Cage or Clay or T.S. Eliot. And you mentioned Emerson, Thoreau earlier. These very eccentric lineages of thought, I've been sort of returning to them as trying to bypass the Enlightenment, which sort of has prevented me from engaging with them. I don't know how people like Thoreau or John Cage or Clay or whoever, or Eliot, managed to bypass the Enlightenment and not see these people who were writing these thoughts down and passing them on as people wearing turbans or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know? Because that's the picture that comes to my mind. He's a sage wearing a particular kind of clothing under a tree. You know, flute music in the background or whatever. How they bypass that or Matthew Arnold, for instance, and engaged with it is fascinating. But I've been trying to do that of late, of bypassing the mental kind of pictures I have whenever I think of that domain. And it's fascinating what comes up. And of course, one of the terms over there, and since we are talking about the upbeat as not being expressed mimetically through art. So, art does not mimetically express joy. Our joy is not to do with success, doing well at the stock market, or in your studies or whatever. This joy that I'm talking about, the Upanishadic word for it is ananda, ananda. I've been sort of trying to look at that, because for me, ananda or delight is a very important thing, but it is not a mimetic delight. Coming back to this non-mimetic delight, I'd like to just, if I may, just share two examples. One is maybe not such a great example. The other one is, and this is besides Nietzsche and the Birth of Tragedy, which you've already mentioned, because he speaks about the early tragedy in terms of, basically in terms of joy, in terms of ecstasy. So it's not as if he turns to something upbeat to talk about ecstasy when he's proposing ecstasy. The two instances that I've been, the one I encountered very recently, it may not be the best example. It's because I was watching Hannah and her sisters, Woody Allen, on a flight, and I realized I'd seen it before. But anyway, I watched it, and the Woody Allen character is not the central character in this film. But however, he is there. He's a hypochondriac, and he's begun to have some sort of a sensation of a ringing in his ears, and he goes to the doctor to check whether. So the doctor, kind of just to be safe, asks for some sort of a scan, Then he comes back to, he's a script writer. He comes back to his office, he's talking to a friend or a secretary, I can't remember, a woman. And he says that, this is terrible. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what's happening to me, whether I'm going to die. And then the woman says, it's probably nothing at all, So what? No, it could be. I mean, ringing in the ears, and he's taking a scan. It could be something really terrible. And she says, what do you mean, like cancer? And he says, don't say that word, please. And then he says, ruminatively, that I was so happy this morning. I mean, before I went to the doctor, I was so happy. She says, you weren't happy at all. You were miserable this morning. And he said, I thought I was miserable. I wasn't aware of the fact that I was happy. And this is one slightly weak example of non-mimetic joy, a joy which doesn't come from the happy smiling face. It is a part of our unawareness. It is what underlies, not underlies, sorry, that gives a sense of depth. It is who we are in moments of vacancy. We are not aware of being happy. That's one example. And the second one, which is might be a better example, is I think from a letter or from diary by Thomas Hardy's wife, Florence, writing down this kind of thing, that he has, there is a spring in his step. This is because he has written a poem. Needless to say, it is a dismal poem. That is non-mimetic joy. We cannot do without it. Mimetic joy, that is joy from the kind of realized outcome, is not what Nietzsche was talking about when he talked about early tragedy. He's talking about something that has no connection to that kind of the paradigm of fulfillment, the vocabulary, of triumph. We can't do without this particular dimension of writing, of the arts, of thought, And I'm sorry if I'm sounding prescriptive. I don't mean to be.
No, I think no, that's wonderful. That's perfect. Look, I think we can be heading towards the end now. I would like to mention, I don't know how to say his name, Satyajit Ray, briefly, if
Yeah,
that, did I say that well enough?
that
Well,
I is Bengali and Ray is the way people who are not Bengali pronounce his name, and
okay.
but you've got it completely right. Yes.
Okay. Wow. Yes. Nothing's completely right. Well, I just so this is a filmmaker who I encountered for his, greatest of all time films, which is the Apu trilogy, which are, neo-realist stories of poverty and tragedy, and they are astonishing films. And I just sort of thought I was, done with him. Like I said, I watched the three important ones, and then I just started watching more of his movies and discovered that he had made, films about modernity and, adventure films, and also that he was, one of the greatest and most important writers of the 20th century. All of this stuff totally inaccessible to me, who had only encountered him as, great filmmaker of all time. And when I started trying to make sense of this figure who I could not make sense of, I read your essay on Rai and responding to Kurosawa. And you just, I mean, I guess I just want to say, and you can say whatever you want about Rai and this essay after this, but I encountered your work. I mean, I'd read some of your work before, but for the first time, I came to understand what you were up to when you were using Rai's suggestion that in a certain way he had encountered Kurosawa, A, as a figure, at the top of a tradition with many layers, as opposed to just the single representative figure, which Kurosawa so often is, or he's one, it used to be three: Kurosawa, Mizoguchi, and Ozu. Now it's just two. Mizoguchi has been forgotten. But two, the way that, Tokyo and Japan is, in a certain way, was a foreign or exotic culture to Rai, in a way that Kolkata would not be, in relationship to London. And this complication, this destabilization of these categories. And so instead of the two great masters of two Oriental traditions, and you did something completely else with them, that just opened my eyes to a new way of seeing Rai's films, which are just wonderful. And my favorite of them actually are the modern day ones, I think it's called The Big City, or the one where the guy works in the fan factory. I mean, I just, these movies, I love them, but also it
Company
introduced me.
Limited. Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead. I
I think it's Company Limited in the English
Yes,
version.
Company Limited. And
Yeah.
then just your way of thinking through the traditions and where these people stood in these traditions, and showing me this entire tradition, as we've been talking about for this entire hour, that had been foreclosed to me by this, greatest filmmaker of all time. And now I've got a book of the Feluda stories, which I'm making my way through, and they're delightful. And it's just, I didn't know it was there, and I could never have seen it without your work.
Okay, thank you. I'm glad. Ray is also, I think, at his best, a remarkable critic as well, and a very good, a wonderful stylist of essayistic English prose, in which he writes his criticism, and this kind of response to Rashomon is contained in a is expressed in a. And an essay in English. I really found it very, very helpful to kind of read his response and read between the lines of his response to Rashomon and to Kurosawa, where he says, this basically is saying, it came from a fully formed cinematic culture, So he says it's the fruition of something, it's a culmination of something then in that case. So again, when we confront Ray, again, we have to think, what is this a culmination of? Or what is this the fruition of in that culture? And and to see things as standalone works of genius never opens us up to the fact that this is the fruition of something, and I too at this moment am the fruition of some sort of process which allows me to recognize that thing, although that thing reportedly belongs to another culture. There are lines drawn within and around cultures on whose one side or the other we are, which either forecloses the experience of watching Rashomon to us or opens it up, depending on which side of the line we are on. It's not because I'm Japanese that or interested in Japan that Rashomon speaks to me, or I'm not interested in Japan, so Rashomon is not going to be of interest to me. It's to do with our relationship to modernity. Then what is this modernity? If it puts into question these kind of what we know about national identities and their itinerary. Yeah, so that's what was of interest to me over there. Yeah.
Yeah, and that, go ahead.
No, it spoke to me and how I think I, how I have experienced things and the world. And I've also noticed how people respond to things and are often blind to things which they could respond to, but they can't because they are caught up within a sort of, for the want of a better word, a metaphysical paradigm, you know.
No, I think and yeah, national identity is a metaphysical paradigm. It's obviously an incredibly dangerous one politically, but it also prevents us from seeing and understanding works of art and culture and seeing our relationship to them. And in that respect, it's also dangerous or problematic, let me say.
Yeah, no, I mean, the way we look at works of art and, you know, artifacts from other so-called other cultures doesn't point towards the fact that we are all human, universal human beings at the core, but the fact that our national identities are full of very diffuse forms of disagreements and agreements across identities. We are all, some of us are searching for certain forms of expression, and national identity is not the prism through which we actually experience any of these things when we are truly drawn to them. It's because we are culturally on one side of this kind of these developments in modernity or the other. What is the one side or the other? Well, we could vaguely say that one side is the Platonic or the Enlightenment side, and the other is the one in conversation with cracks in that particular edifice. And that kind of, I think, determines the way we experience things much more than the ideas given to us of what a national identity is. Even a national identity comprises these conversations.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And yet, the goal of a national identity is to, in some ways, hide or elide the fact that it comprises these
absolutely.
Conversations.
It's to insert us into a fairy tale.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Yes.
Well, I only have a couple thousand more things I would like to talk to you about, but I think we can leave it here, except for you. Anything else you would like to add before we go?
Not really. Again, I mean, I could keep adding.
Yes. Well, perhaps another time we can add some more. But this is enough for now. The book is Incompleteness: New and Selected Essays, and I. Thank you for the time. Much more, though. Thank you. Thank you for doing this work. It's wonderful.
Thank you so much. That's very kind of you, very generous, and thank you.